Thank you, Tina. And also, I owe thanks to Vivian Nutton, who is a member of this august society, who, when I started working on Vesalius, published my first essay in translation of Vesalius on the larynx and hyoid bone in medical history when he was editor of that journal. So I'm grateful to him for opening that opportunity. I hear some, am I better now? I can move this, okay? And so this is the 500th anniversary of the birth of Andreas Vesalius. And so there have been many events in his honor all over the world. It's been my good luck and privilege to attend many of those events. The project which got me that privilege was the translation of the Fabrica, De Humani Corporis Fabrica, which was written in 1540, first published in 1543, a second edition in 1555. And between that, Vesalius' foray into the field of pharmacology. That is what I'm going to talk about today is Andreas Vesalius as a pharmacist. Now, we have our first, yes, item here, and I can change the slides down here. So Vesalius, born in 1514, was the son of an apothecary. His father, Andries van Vesele, he served, the father, that is, served as apothecary to Charles V, who was a Holy Roman Emperor. And it was probably the support of Charles V that allowed the very unforgettable illustrations, the woodcut illustrations, are what really made the Fabrica an immortal document. There were over 243 of those illustrations, some of them the large muscle men, which you may have seen. They're published on everything from teacups to t-shirts now because of their importance as a work of Western art. It was Vesalius who really was responsible for the entry of human anatomy into the way that we see. We're always learning to see things with fresh eyes. And the anatomical illustrations of Vesalius were very important in educating our vision. And he is, among other things, the father of anatomical imagery, which is now a very hot topic with all of the technology that accompanies the examination of the human body. But this isn't so much about that as it is about Vesalius as an apothecary or as a student of ancient medicine. Vesalius remarked that ancient medicine relied upon three branches of the healing art, of which the first was, as he wrote, the first was a system of diet, the second, medication, and the third, surgery, which included the work of the hands, for example, to reset fractures and dislocations, whether or not they entailed cutting. That was his specialty. He was appointed to the University of Padua in 1537 as a professor of anatomy and surgery, disciplines in which he had shown himself of great genius during his earlier medical studies at Paris and Louvain. In the first book of his great anatomical atlas, De Humani Corporis Fabrica, which I mentioned before, published in 1543, Vesalius appears to suggest that he was thinking about a polemic contrasting medicine and medication and medicine as anatomy and surgery, the work of the hands. But this guess depends upon only three passages in the beginning, the first book of seven of the Fabrica, and they were not repeated in the remaining books of the Fabrica. So we have an apparent change of mind even as he was writing. He was only 28 when he finished the project, and so he was a bit of a beginner. Think of what you knew when you were 28. You knew a lot less than you know now, whatever you do. So in those passages that I mentioned, the three in the very beginning of the Fabrica, Vesalius refers disparagingly to syrups and juleps, sweet medications whose names are derived from the Arabic. Now, one of the things you know about humanist medicine, 16th century medicine, is that they were trying to escape from the profound influence and great achievements of Arabic medicine. And so there is a certain snobbery about mentioning syrups and juleps. It was the essence of what is corrupt. Let us but call our minds away for now from syrups and juleps, he writes in chapter 21. And a few chapters later, he writes, with approval of physicians who applied themselves properly to the Hippocratic art, who were not born just for scribbling about syrups and imposing upon people. The note of scorn for apothecaries is confirmed later in the same chapter, where he rejects the notion that we can impose upon mortals with our syrups and fill our cash boxes. Very cynical application. I'm going to try to move this ahead. And there is Charles V, painted by Titian in 1533. The Fabrica's introductory dedication to this patron, Charles V, argues that the branch of medicine concerned with medication has been abandoned to druggists. As soon as all preparation of medicine was relegated to druggists, doctors soon lost the knowledge of simple medicines that was absolutely essential to them. It is their fault that the workshops of apothecaries teem with barbaric words and indeed false drugs. That we lack so many of the best compounds of the ancients, and that many are still not even known to us. This cynical view of the apothecary's art seems to anticipate remarks heard today about Big Pharma. But this was not Big Pharma, this was Little Pharma. And if we can talk about the Little Pharma without the huge organization and political clout of the modern drug industry, we can talk about Little Pharma, if we may use the word. It was as unregulated as it still is today, at least in the United States. The medicines sold, whether compounded or simple, were unverifiable and depended upon the integrity of the apothecary who sold them. This situation still persists in the United States, and as you know from reading the newspapers, we specialize in illegality. And I'll give you two recent news items to illustrate this. This is a rather fuzzy picture. In October 2012, a New England Compounding Center in Framingham, a suburb of Boston, was found responsible for a three-month outbreak of Aspergillus meningitis that sickened people in 19 states, including Florida, Maryland, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia, and caused at least 64 deaths. More than 400 people were infected. One medication, methylprednisone acetate, a steroid, was prepared at the New England Compounding Center, which has since closed, and its assets have been, and those of Barry Codden, its co-owner and manager, had been seized, but nothing had been done to prevent the infections and the resulting deaths. Herbal supplements. In the spirit of full disclosure, I have to say that I once bought some herbal supplement. I bought some St. John's wort at the urging of my wife, Tina, who's sitting in the back of this room, hoping that it would improve my character. which wasn't very good to start with. This year, again in the United States, a questionable value of unregulated medications is concentrated in, quote, fraudulent and potentially dangerous herbal supplements sold by major retailers such as GNC. I don't know if you have that, but it's a very big organization in the U.S. GNC, Target, Walgreens. I must say, Walgreens now owns Boots, so be warned. Walgreens and Walmart. Pills labeled as medicinal herbs often contain little more than cheap fillers, such as powdered rice, asparagus, and houseplants. Sometimes they contain potentially dangerous substances, such as peanuts and soybeans, that can bring on allergic reactions. Walgreens sells a bottle, a house brand of ginseng that contains only powdered garlic and rice. Walmart sells ginkgo biloba as a memory enhancer. I need some of that. It was found to contain little more than powdered radish, houseplants, and wheat, despite a claim on the label that it contains no wheat or gluten. Dietary supplements account for nearly 20% of drug-related liver injuries that show up in hospitals, up from 7% a decade ago. Americans spend an estimated $32 billion on dietary supplements every year, attracted by unproven claims that various pills and powders will help them lose weight, build muscle, and fight off everything from colds to chronic illnesses. About half of Americans use dietary supplements, and most of them take more than one product at a time, according to the New York Times. These findings were anticipated 472 years ago by Vesalius' charges against the apothecaries of his time, about whom I can give you no news items. The reputation of drugs in the United States did not begin, the regulation of drugs did not begin until 1906 with the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act. By then, medicines and other products for internal consumption could be based upon any combination of minerals, opiates, and other stimulants such as cocaine. This popular beverage, Coca-Cola, contained cocaine until 1903, although the Coca-Cola company denies this stoutly. But a federal law enacted in 1993, the Dietary Supplement Health and Publication Education Act, prevents the Food and Drug Administration from approving or evaluating most supplements before they are sold. Usually, the agency must wait until consumers are harmed before officials can remove products from shelves. And here's some opium for you. Vesalius' scorn for medication seems to be echoed 3 years after the Fabrica in the Epistle on the China Root, where he remarks on doctors who have nothing to do with medicine except with certain drugs that relieve the bowel, syrups that prepare humors for evacuation, and with several evacuating medications and some formulas for pricking and fomentations, and so on. The one medication that he writes on in the Epistle on the China Root is pictured here. By the time he wrote this epistle, 3 years after the first edition of the Fabrica, the China Root has turned the corner on pharmacy. Instead of disparaging the use of medication, he regrets that doctors have lost touch with a branch of the medical art and turns his attention to an appraisal of one particular medication, a decoction of the so-called China root, Smilax China, that was in demand for any of the three maladies of privileged class that were incurable and sometimes fatal: kidney and bladder stones, gout, the patrician's malady, and syphilis. Stone, for example, afflicted the humanist scholar and physician Thomas Linacre, the author Erasmus, Queen Elizabeth's secretary and spymaster Francis Walsingham, Michel de Montaigne, Oliver Cromwell, John Dryden, Samuel Pepys, and Isaac Newton. Gout tortured the Medici patriarch Cosimo de' Medici, his son Piero il Gottoso, the gouty, and Vesalius' patron, Charles V. His medical colleague, Ambroise Paré, Elizabeth's chief advisor, William Cecil, and scores of other notables. Because syphilis, the mal francese, bore the stigma of sexual incontinence, its victims were often unacknowledged. They may have included Cesare Borgia, the English monarch Henry VIII, and the Russian Tsar Ivan the Terrible, giving new meaning to terrible. And it certainly included numerous princes of the church, including Girolamo de Rovere, who became Pope Julius II in 1503. Later victims included Franz Schubert, who died at the age of 31 in 1828. Because Vesalius had resigned his professorship at Padua after publication of the Fabrica in 1543, he entered the service of Charles V to serve as a member of his medical staff. The Holy Roman Emperor, the most powerful man in Europe, was also a glutton, who ignored the attempts of his doctors to regulate his diet or his excessive lifestyle. The resultant gout and other maladies caused him constant discomfort, leading to his abdication in 1555 in favor of his son, Philip II of Spain. Until then, Charles sought every remedy known to the wealthy that might relieve his gout. One of the most famous was the so-called China root, which was boiled down to form a decoction administered at various times of the day to relieve the symptoms of whatever ailed the patient. Still used today in traditional Chinese medicine, its aqueous extract is believed to have anti-inflammatory and analgesic properties, making it roughly comparable to aspirin, whatever additional placebo effects it may have had. It was introduced into Europe as early as 1525 as a widely known specific against syphilis. By 1535, it was thought to promote perspiration and urine and was used for a variety of other diseases, including gout and stone. But it remained unmentioned by the leading botanists of the time. One of the things that was also being published during the middle of the 16th century was illustrated botanical manuals. And so most known botanicals were published in illustrated editions, often hand-colored. So it was much studied, and it is significant that the China root is not in any of those manuals, perhaps because it was hard to get. Its popularity among those who could afford it made a celebrated panacea at the time, where few medications, and nearly all of them based on plants, had any curative powers. But there was no published professional analysis of the China root's administration or its effectiveness when used as directed. There was no U.S. Pharmacopoeia that was founded in 1820, or Food and Drug Administration to gauge and enforce the health and effectiveness of medicines. The United States Pharmacopoeial Convention is more than a domestic institution for the United States. It sets standards used in more than 140 countries worldwide. The need for such a convention, as was founded in the U.S. Pharmacopoeia, is illustrated by the need for a professional assessment of this new wonder drug. In 1546, Vesalius, now famous as the author of the Fabrica and its epitome, and a ranking member of Charles V's medical staff with a busy clinical practice among the leaders of Europe, was the ideal physician to issue an appraisal of the China Root. The Epistle of the China Root was so called because it is a memorandum or a monograph rather than a full-length book. As only about 31 of the book's 200 pages was actually devoted to discussion of the China Root and its administration, it is evident that Vesalius was using that discussion as a means to deliver another message. That message was the importance of a modern work on human anatomy and the inaccuracy of Galen's ancient writings about anatomy, which was based on animal but not human dissection. His claim that the China Root epistle was his response to a request from a colleague in the Belgian city of Mechelen may be the pretext for presenting this book, which is chiefly an apologia for his own anatomical work, a summary of errors by Galen and a defense against attacks by loyalists of Galenism, especially his one-time professor in Paris, Jacobius Silvius, who is now his enemy. All of this narrows our investigation of Vesalius as a pharmacist to his to less than three dozen pages of a single work. Those pages turn out to be another example of the author's persistently skeptical methods. The China Root was a novel treatment, substituted by some doctors and patients for guaiac wood or lignum vitae, from which was distilled an oil or a gum. Guaiac had been introduced to Spain from the West Indies in 1508 and made popular in 1519 as a treatment for, you guessed it, syphilis. It was also used for gout. Because neither treatment had any curative effect, fashion allowed an easy shift of treatment between the two decoctions. Interest in the China Root soared when word went about that it was administered to Charles V. But the emperor's habits were so irregular, his diet so rich, and his resistance to any lasting regimen so strong, that it was unlikely the China Root could have any practical effect on his gout. Vesalius describes the source, appearance, taste, and preparation of the China Root. He also details the claims that have been made for its powers. And he writes the following: I am unable to comprehend how something that many have long since credited to the China Root comes to be ascribed to it, and with what new impulse it now begins to be credited with new powers as its fame grows. Presumably, it is hot, possessing the faculty of opening. It notably brings on urination and sweating. It is found to be a consumer and dryer of redundant and harmful substances and any number of different fluids, and is thus a cleanser of the blood. It possesses the virtue of assuaging and cleansing. It keeps the belly, now loose and now when it chiefly brings on urines and sweats, tight. It is a remedy for a stomach beset with phlegm. It drives off diseases of the liver and spleen in no small way. It is an effective protection for those whom the stone torments and breaks it up. It drives off gout, especially benefits elephantiacs, cures skin diseases, and is no ordinary help for fistulas and malign and otherwise incurable ulcers. It divinely heals the gullet disease in both recently and earlier infected patients, heals the ulcers caused by it, and repairs the scars. It crushes agonies in any limb, dissolves tumors, and aids any that are about to separate by heating, then opening, cleaning, and producing a scar. It brings health to corruptions and abscesses in the bones, relaxes convulsed and contracted sinews, dries those that are slackened and softened, and heats sinews that have been numbed by the gallic disease. It fattens sinews troubled by wasting therefrom. It induces a pleasing odor to bodies that are festering and corpse-like, removes bad breath, and protects those who have trouble breathing. It scatters lengthy anginas, drives off injuries to the brain resulting from the gallic disease, and halts every kind of fluxion with an uncommon benefit. So he describes the claims. For his part, Vesalius remains unconvinced that the powers of the China root could not be ascribed to any spongy and rotten wood. None of this skepticism prevented him from going on with a method of preparing the China decoction. The assumption that the physician does not merely administer the medicine, he prepares it himself or personally supervises its preparation. As he says, a man long learned in the practices of our art and the greatest help of his fellow citizens. He also prescribes the intervals at which the decoction should be administered, as well as the amount to be consumed at each interval. These details seem to be based upon procedures used for GIAC. The patient's diet during treatment is also prescribed. Given the emperor's well-known habits of gluttony, it is no surprise that Vesalius recommends a light diet. By the same token, Vesalius recommends, quote, long conversation about pleasant topics and indulgence in sex for patients being treated with the China root. Vesalius concludes the pharmaceutical portion of the China root epistle with some remarks about other plant-based medications such as sarsaparilla, cinquefoil or tormentilla erecta, chamaedrus or germander, terebinth, and medicinal forms of rhubarb called rapontic and hippolapathos. Having in this way displayed his clinical knowledge of medicinal plants, Vesalius ends his evaluation of the China root by calling it the foolish China, stupida China, which could also be understood as ineffectual or torpid. We are now at the top of page 39 of the epistle's nearly 200 pages, the rest of which are devoted to explaining the thrust of his work on the Fabrica, his education, and the attacks of his former professor at Paris, Jacques Dubois, or Johannes Sylvius. His evaluation of the China root has displayed his knowledge of clinical medicine and pharmacy on the subject of a wonder drug of the time, but the work as a whole concentrates on anatomy. Like his work on anatomy, Vesalius' foray into pharmacy displays a tendency to skepticism embedded in a tag from the Roman poet Horace, given to swear by the words of no man, nullius addictus jurare in verba magistri, from the epistles. This tag is repeated 5 times in the Fabrica and twice in the epistle on the China root. Initially intended by Vesalius to characterize his unwillingness to take Galen's words at face value, this phrase became an emblem of scientific skepticism and the motto, as you see here, the motto of the Royal Society, founded in 1660. By the time he came to write his epistle on the China root, Vesalius was unwilling to portray himself only as a skeptic, only as a challenger of Galenism, or a polemicist. Near the end of the epistle, he wrote that it is not sufficient to occupy oneself in speaking ill of somebody or ridiculing the effects of others, when one should rather be working up a sweat in common efforts at the truth and believing that we too were born human. In the Fabrica and the Epistle of the China Root, he sought to reunite the medical disciplines of diet, surgery, and pharmacy under a single professional calling. Thank you for your patience. I might mention in addition that portrait of Azaleas is quite remarkable. His plan was to write, after he finished the Fabrica, was to write a book on pathological anatomy. And it's curious to see, and I invite any of you to stand by a table and see if the table ever comes to your waist. He is advertising his own unusual anatomy, comparing his hand to the hand of a cadaver. Both hands, you see, are very short and stumpy. You can see a lordosis of the spine. It appears to make his stomach stick forward, and his head is very large. This is the only known authentic portrait of Azaleas used in his own books. And so he seems to be emphasizing that he is a person with himself a non-standard anatomy. So he is a standout in his field, but he's also a non-standard person also. Curious little footnote, too. Who was Azaleas, and what did he look like? Thank you, Tina.